This locking of the extremities of the body helps to prevent the outflow of magnetism from the fingertips, feet, etc. The position should be easy and relaxed, the head not sunken upon the chest but lightly balanced, the eyes and mouth closed, the spinal column, along which there is much magnetic flow, erect. Eastern people usually sit cross-legged on the floor or a low stool, a position which is said to be slightly more effectual since any magnetism liberated tends to rise around the body in a protective shell. Another factor to be considered in determining the posture for meditation is the possibility of losing physical consciousness. The Indian who is sitting on the floor simply falls backwards without hurting the body. Those who meditate in a chair will do well to make use of an armchair so that, in the event of the body losing consciousness, they may not fall out of it. Except in very rare cases, the lying down position should not be adopted, on account of its natural tendency towards sleep. A cold bath or a brisk walk beforehand is useful in order to overcome any tendency to sluggish circulation of the blood, which is obviously detrimental to brain activity. There is an intimate connection between profound meditation and breathing. It is found in practice that as the body becomes harmonized in meditation, the breathing grows deeper, regular and rhythmic, until by degrees it becomes so slow and quiet as to be almost imperceptible. The yoga reverses the process, and by deliberate regulation of the breathing seeks to harmonize the functions of the body, and finally, the workings of the mind. The student, however, should be warned against the indiscriminate practice of breathing exercises. He will be far better advised to learn to control of thought along the lines of Raja Yoga, leaving his efforts at meditation to work their natural effect on the physical body. Whilst some breathing exercises are exceedingly dangerous, there is no objection to simple, deep breathing provided undue strain is not placed upon the heart and lungs, and no attempt is made to concentrate the thought on the various centers, or chakrams, of the body. Good incense is also helpful, as it tends to purify the atmosphere from the occult standpoint. The student may also gain assistance from beautiful colors, flowers and pictures in his surroundings, and other means of uplifting the mind and feelings. He will also find it useful to observe certain dietetic restrictions, vidhi the astral body, p. 65, and, if it can be done without detriment to health, to abstain from flesh food and alcohol. If alcohol is taken, meditation is a partment to set up inflammatory symptoms in the brain affecting particularly the pituitary body, vidhi the astral body, p. 66. Early morning is probably the most suitable time for meditation because desires and emotions are usually more tranquil after sleep and before the man plunges into the bustle of the world. But whatever time is chosen, it should be when there is assurance of being undisturbed. Moreover, as already pointed out, it should always be at the same time, for regularity is of the essence of the prescription. The times selected by ancient devotees were sunrise, noon and sunset, these being magnetically the most suitable. It is well to cultivate the habit of turning the mind for a moment at the stroke of every hour during the day to the realization of oneself as the spiritual man. This practice leads to what Christian mystics called self-recollectedness, and helps the student to train his mind to revert automatically to spiritual thoughts. It is not well to meditate immediately after a meal, for the obvious reason that it tends to draw blood away from the digestive organs. Neither is meditation at night good, because the bodies are tired and the etheric double is more readily displaceable. In addition, the negative influence of the moon is then operative, so that undesirable results are more liable to occur. Sometimes meditation may be less successful than usual because of unfavorable astral or mental influences. It is stated also by some people that at certain times the planetary influences are more favorable than at others. Thus, an astrologer has said that when Jupiter had certain relations with the moon, this had the effect of expanding the etheric atmosphere and making meditation appear more successful. Certain aspects with Saturn, on the other hand, were said to congest the etheric atmosphere, making meditation difficult. The system of meditation briefly outlined above has as its objects spiritual, mental and ethical development, and control of the mind and feelings. It does not aim at developing psychic faculties from below upwards, but its natural result may be to open up a form of intuitive psychism in persons of sufficiently sensitive organization, which will show itself in increasing sensitiveness to the influence of people and places, in the recalling of fragmentary memories of astral plane experiences in sleep, in greater susceptibility to direct guidance from the ego, in the power to recognize the influence of the masters and spiritually developed people, and so forth. Meditation may result in illumination, which may be one of three quite different things. 1. By intense and careful thinking over a subject, a man may himself arrive at some conclusion with respect to it. 2. He may obtain illumination from his higher self, discovering what his ego really thinks on his own plane about the question. 3. He may, if highly developed, come into touch with masters or devas. It is in 1. Only that his conclusions would be likely to be vitiated by his own thought forms, the higher self would be able to transcend these, and so would a master or a deva. What we can do in meditation depends upon what we are doing all day long. If we have prejudices, for example, in ordinary life, we cannot escape from them in meditation. Physical meditation is, of course, for the training of the lower vehicles, not for the ego. During meditation, the ego regards the personality much as at any other time he is usually slightly contemptuous. If the ego is at all developed, he will meditate upon his own level, but that meditation need not, of course, synchronize with that of the personality. Meditation is one means of acquiring the art of leaving the body in full consciousness. The consciousness being braced up to an unswerving steadiness and fixity, the attention is gradually withdrawn from the outer world and the body, the senses remaining quiet page 158 while the mind is intensely alive, but with all its energies drawn inwards ready to be launched at a single point of thought, the highest to which it can attain. When it is able to hold itself thus with comparative ease by a strong but calm effort of will, it can throw itself beyond the highest thought it can reach while working in the physical brain, and in that effort will rise to, and unite itself with, the higher consciousness and find itself free from the body. When this is done, there is no sense of sleep or dream nor any loss of consciousness. The man finds himself outside his body, as though he had slipped off a weighty encumbrance, not as though he had lost any part of himself. There are other ways of obtaining freedom from the body, for example, by the rapt intensity of devotion, or by special methods that may be imparted by a great teacher to his pupil. The man can return to his body and re-enter it at will. Also, under these circumstances, he can impress on the brain, and thus retain while in the physical body, the memory of the experiences he has undergone. Real meditation means a strenuous effort, not the sensation of happiness which arises from a state of semi-somnolence and bodily luxury. It has, therefore, nothing to do with, and, in fact, is quite different from, the kind of passive mediumship developed in spiritualism. The student need not be puzzled by the injunction that he should open himself to spiritual influences and at the same time be positive. Positive effort is needed as a preliminary. This uplifts the consciousness to higher levels so that the higher influences can play down. Then, and only then, is it safe to relax the upward striving in the realization of the peace thus attained. The phrase opening oneself to spiritual influences may be taken to mean maintaining an attitude of intense stillness at a high spiritual level, much as a bird, though seemingly passive and immobile, poises itself against the gale by a powerful effort continuously maintained in wing and pinion. Chapter 17 Contemplation. Contemplation is the third of the three stages, of which we have already considered two. The three are, 1. Concentration, the riveting of the attention on an object. 2. Meditation, the stirring of the consciousness into activity with reference to that object alone, looking at the object in every possible light, and trying to penetrate its meaning, to reach new and deep thought or receive some intuitional light upon it. 3. Contemplation, the active centering of the consciousness on the object, while the lower activities of the consciousness are successfully repressed, the fixation of the attention for a time on the light received. It has been defined as concentration at the top of the line of thought or meditation. In the Hindu terminology, the stages are amplified and named as follows. 1. Pratyahara, the preliminary stage, embracing entire control of the senses. 2. Dharana, concentration. 3. Dhyana, meditation. 4. Samadhi, contemplation. Dharana, Dhyana and Samadhi are known collectively as Samyama. In meditation we discover what the object is as compared with other things, and in relation to them. We go on with this process of reasoning and argument until we can reason and argue no more about an object. Then we suppress the process, stopping all comparing and arguing, with the attention fixed actively upon the object, trying to penetrate the indefiniteness which for us appears to surround it. That is contemplation. The beginner should bear in mind that meditation is a science of a lifetime, so that he should not expect to attain to the stage of pure contemplation in his earlier efforts. Contemplation may be described also as keeping the consciousness on one thing and drawing it into oneself so that the thinker and it become one. When a well-trained mind can maintain its one-pointedness or concentration for some time, and can then drop the object, maintaining the fixed attention, but without the attention being directed to anything, then the stage of contemplation is reached. In this stage the mental body shows no image, its own materials are held steady and firm, receiving no impressions, perfectly calm, like still water. This state cannot last for more than a very brief period, being like the critical state of the chemist, the point between two states of matter. Expressed in another way, as the mental body is stilled, the consciousness escapes from it and passes into and out of the lower center, the neutral points of contact between the mental and the causal body. This passage is accompanied by a momentary swoon, or loss of consciousness, the inevitable result of the disappearance of objects of consciousness, followed by consciousness in the higher body. The dropping out of objects of consciousness belonging to the lower worlds is thus followed by the appearance of objects of consciousness in the higher world. Then the ego can shape the mental body according to his own lofty thoughts, and permeate it with his own vibrations. He can mold it after the visions he has obtained of planes even higher than his own, and can thus convey to the lower consciousness ideas to which the mental body would otherwise be unable to respond. These are the inspirations of genius, that flash down into the mind with dazzling light and illuminate a world. The very man himself who gives them to the world can scarcely tell, in his ordinary mental state, how they have reached him, but he knows that in some strange way, the power within me peeling lives on my lip and beckons with my hand. Of this nature also are the ecstasy and visions of saints, of all creeds and in all ages. In these cases, prolonged and absorbing prayer, or contemplation, has produced the necessary brain condition. The avenues of the senses have become closed by the intensity of the inner concentration, and the same state is reached, spasmodically and involuntarily, which the Raja Yogi seeks deliberately to attain. The transition from meditation to contemplation has been described as passing from meditation with seed to meditation without seed. Having steadied the mind, it is held poised. On the highest point of the reasoning, the last link in the chain of argument, or on the central thought or figure of the whole process, that is meditation with seed, then the student should let everything go, but still keeping the mind in the position gained, the highest point reached, vigorous and alert. That is meditation without seed. Remaining poised, waiting in the silence and the void, the man is in the cloud. Then suddenly there will be a change unmistakable, stupendous, incredible. This is contemplation leading to illumination. Thus, for example, practicing contemplation on the ideal man, on a master. Having formed an image of the master, the student contemplates it with ecstasy, filling himself with its glory and its beauty, and then straining upwards towards him, he endeavors to raise his consciousness to the ideal, to merge himself in it, to become one with it. The momentary swoon mentioned above is called in Sanskrit the Dharma Megha, the cloud of righteousness. Western mystics speak of it as the cloud on the mount, the cloud on the sanctuary, the cloud on the mercy seat. The man feels as though surrounded by a dense mist, conscious that he is not alone, but unable to see. Presently the cloud thins, and the consciousness of the higher plane dawns. but before it does so it seems to the man that his very life is draining away, that he is hanging in the void of great darkness unspeakably lonely. But be still, and know that I am God. In that silence and stillness the voice of the Self shall be heard, the glory of the Self shall be seen. The cloud vanishes and the Self is made manifest. Before it is possible to pass from meditation to contemplation, wishing and hoping must be entirely given up, at least during the period of practice. In other words, karma must be perfectly under control. The mind can never be single while wishes occupy it. Every wish is a seed from which may spring anger, untruthfulness, impurity, resentment, greed, carelessness, discontent, sloth, ignorance, etc. While one wish of hope remains, these violations of the law are possible. So long as there are wishes, non-satisfactions, they will call one aside. The stream of thought is ever seeking to flow aside into little gullies and channels left open by unsatisfied desires and indecisive thought. Every unsatisfied desire, every unthought-out problem, will present a hungry mouth ever calling aside the attention. When the train of thought meets a difficulty, it will swing aside to attend to these calls. Tracing out interrupted chains of thought, it will be found that they have their source in unsatisfied desires and unsettled problems. The process of contemplation commences when the conscious activity begins to run, as it were, at right angles to the usual activity, which endeavors to understand a thing in reference to other things of its own nature and plane. Such movement cuts across the planes of its existence and penetrates into its subtler inner nature. When the attention is no longer divided into parts by the activities of comparing, the mind will move as a whole, and will seem quite still, just as a spinning top may appear to stand still when it is in most rapid motion. In contemplation one no longer thinks about the object. It is better even not to start with any idea of the self and the object as two different things in relation to one another, because to do so will tend to color the idea with feeling. The endeavor should be made to reach such a point of self-detachment that the contemplation can start from inside the object itself, the mental enthusiasm and energy being at the same time kept up all along the line of thought. The consciousness is to be held, poised like a bird on the wing, looking forward and never thinking of turning back. In contemplation the thought is carried inwards until it can go no further. It is held in that position without going back or turning aside, knowing that there is something there, although it is unable to grasp clearly what it is. In this contemplation there is, of course, nothing in the nature of sleep or mental activity, but an intense search, a prolonged effort to see in the indefiniteness something definite, without descending to the ordinary lower regions of conscious activity in which the vision is normally clear and precise. A devotee would practice contemplation in a similar manner, but in his case the activity would be mainly feeling rather than thought. In contemplation on his own nature, the student repudiates his identity with the outer bodies and with the mind. In this process he is not divesting himself of attributes, but of limitations. The mind is swifter and freer than the body, and beyond the mind is spirit, which is freer and swifter still. Love is more possible in the quietude of the heart than in any outer expression, but in the spirit beyond the mind it is divinely certain. Reason and judgment ever correct the halting evidence of the senses. The vision of the spirit discerns the truth without organs and without mind. The key to success at every step of these practices may be stated thus: obstruct the lower activities, while maintaining the full flow of conscious energy. First, the lower mind must be made vigorous and alert, then its activity must be obstructed while the impetus gained is used to exercise and develop the higher faculties within. An ancient science of yoga teaches, when the processes of the thinking mind are repressed by the active will, the man finds himself in a new state of consciousness which transcends the ordinary thinking and governs it. Just as thought transcends and selects among desires, and just as desires prompt to particular actions and efforts, such a superior state of consciousness cannot be described in terms of the lower mind, but its attainment means that the man is conscious that he is something above mind and thought even though mental activity may be going on, just as all cultured people recognize that they are not the physical body, even when that body may be acting. There is thus another state of existence, or rather another living conception of life, beyond the mind with its labored processes of discernment, of comparisons and causal relations between things. That higher state is to be realized only when the activities of consciousness are carried, in all their earthly fervor and vigor, beyond the groping cave life in which they normally dwell. That higher consciousness will come to all men sooner or later, and when it comes, all life will suddenly appear changed. As the student by his meditation grows richer in spiritual experience, he will thus find new phases of consciousness gradually opening up within him. Fixed in aspiration upon his ideal, he will presently become aware of the influence of that ideal raying down upon him, and as he makes a desperate effort to reach the object of his devotion, for a brief moment the floodgates of heaven itself will be opened and he will find himself made one with his ideal and suffused with the glory of its realization. Having transcended the more formal figures of the mind, an intense effort is made to reach upwards. Then will come the attainment of that state of ecstasy of spirit, when the limits of the personality have fallen away and all shadow of separateness has vanished in the perfect union of object and seeker. As said in the voice of the silence, thou canst not travel on the path before thou hast become that path itself. Behold, thou hast become the light, thou hast become the sound, thou art thy master and thy God. Thou art thyself the object of thy search, the voice unbroken, that resounds throughout eternities, exempt from change, from sin exempt, the seven sounds in one. It were idle to attempt further description of such experiences, for they are beyond the reach of formulated utterance. Words serve but as signposts pointing out the way to that which is ineffably glorious, so that the pilgrim may know whither to direct his steps. Chapter 18 Sleep Life. Many people find themselves troubled with streams of wandering thought when they are trying to fall asleep. In such cases, a mental shell will deliver them from such of these thoughts as come from without. Such a shell need only be temporary, since all that is required is peace for an interval sufficient to allow the man to fall asleep. The man will carry away with him this mental shell when he leaves his physical body, but its work will then be accomplished, its sole object being to enable him to leave his body. Whilst he was in the physical body, the mental action on the brain particles may easily have prevented him quitting the body, but when once he is away from the body, the same worry or wandering thought will not bring him back to it. When the shell breaks up, the stream of idle thoughts or mental worry will probably reassert itself, but as the man will be away from his physical brain, this will not interfere with the repose of the body. It is an extremely rare occurrence for either an ordinary person during sleep, or a psychically developed person in trance condition, to penetrate to the mental plane. Purity of life and purpose would be an absolute prerequisite, and even when a mental plane was reached, there would be nothing that could be called real consciousness, but simply a capacity for receiving impressions. An example showing the possibility of entering the mental plane during sleep may be given. A person of pure mind and considerable though untrained psychic capacity was approached during sleep, and a thought picture was presented to her mind. So intense was the feeling of reverent joy, so lofty and so spiritual were the thoughts evoked by the contemplation of the glorious scene, that the consciousness of the sleeper passed into the mental body, that is, she rose to the mental plane. Although she was floating in the sea of light and color, nevertheless she was entirely absorbed in her own thought, and conscious of nothing beyond it. She remained in that condition for several hours, though apparently unconscious of the passage of time. It is clear in this case, that although the sleeper was conscious on the mental plane, yet she was by no means conscious of it. It seems probable that a result such as this would be possible only in the case of a person having already some amount of psychic development. The same condition is even more definitely necessary in order that a mesmerized subject could touch the mental plane in trance. The reason for this, as previously stated, is that in the average man the mental body is not sufficiently developed to be employed as a separate vehicle of consciousness. It can, in fact, be employed as a vehicle only by those who have been specially trained in its use by teachers belonging to the Great Brotherhood of Initiates. We may repeat here what was said in Chapter 16, viz., that up to the time of the first initiation, a man works at night in his astral body, but as soon as it is perfectly under control, and he is able to use it fully, work in the mental body is begun. When this body in turn is completely organized, it is a far more flexible vehicle than the astral body, and much that is impossible on the astral plane can be accomplished therein. Although a man after death may live in the heaven world, that is, on the mental plane, as we shall see in later chapters, yet he is shut up in a shell of his own thoughts. This cannot be called functioning on the mental plane, for that involves the ability to move about freely on that plane, and to observe what exists there. A man who is able to function freely in the mental body has the capacity of entering upon all the glory and beauty of the mental plane, and possesses, even when working on the astral plane, the far more comprehensive mental sense, which opens up to him such marvelous vistas of knowledge, and practically renders error all but impossible. When functioning in the mental body, a man leaves his astral body behind him along with the physical body. If he wishes to show himself upon the astral plane for any reason, he does not send for his own astral vehicle, but by a single action of his will materializes one for his temporary need. Such an astral materialization is called a mayavirupa, and to form it for the first time usually needs the assistance of a qualified master. This subject will be dealt with in our next chapter. There is another way in which the sleep life can be usefully employed, viz., for solving problems. The method is, of course, practiced by many people, though for the most part unconsciously. It is expressed in the proverb that the night brings counsel. The problem to be solved should be quietly held in the mind when going to sleep. It should not be debated or argued, or sleep may be prevented. It should be merely stated to the mind and left. Then, when during sleep the thinker is freed from the physical body and brain, he will take up the problem and deal with it. Usually the thinker will impress the solution on the brain so that it will be in the consciousness on awakening. It is a good plan to keep paper and pencil by the bed in order to note down the solution immediately on waking, because a thought thus obtained is very readily erased by the thronging stimuli from the physical world, and is not easily recovered. Chapter 19. The Mayavirupa. Mayavirupa means literally body of illusion. It is a temporary astral body made by one who is able to function in the mental body. It may, or may not, resemble the physical body, the form given to it being suitable to the purpose for which it is projected. It may be made, at will, visible or invisible on the physical plane. It can be made indistinguishable from a physical body, warm and firm to the touch, as well as visible, able to carry on a conversation, at all points like a physical being. The advantage of using the Mayavirupa is that it is not subject to glamour on the astral plane, as is the astral body. No astral glamour can overpower the Mayavirupa, or astral illusion deceive it. With the power to form the Mayavirupa, a man is able to pass instantly from the mental plane to the astral and back, and to use at all times the greater power and keener sense on the mental plane. It is necessary to form the astral materialization only when the man wishes to become visible to people in the astral world. When he has finished his work on the astral plane, he withdraws to the mental plane again, and the Mayavirupa vanishes, its materials returning to the general circulation of astral matter, whence they had been drawn by the pupil's will. When in the Mayavirupa, a man may use the mental plane method of thought transference so far as understanding another man is concerned. But, of course, the power of conveying the thought in that way to another is limited by the degree of development of that other man's astral body. It is necessary that the master shall first show his pupil how to make the Mayavirupa, after which, although it is not at first an easy matter, he can do it for himself. After the second initiation, rapid progress is made with the development of the mental body. And it is at or near this point that the pupil learns to use the Mayavirupa. Chapter 20. Devachan, Principles. The first portion of the life after death, spent on the astral plane, has already been fully described in the astral body. We therefore now take up our study from the moment when the astral body is left behind on its own plane, and the man withdraws his consciousness into the mental body, i.e., rises to the mental plane, and in so doing enters what is known as the heaven world. This is usually called by theosophists Devachan, which means literally the shining land. It is also termed in Sanskrit Devastan, the land of the gods. It is the Svarga of the Hindus, the Sakavati of the Buddhists, the heaven of the Zoroastrian, Christian and Mohammedan. It has been called also the Nirvana of the common people. The basic principle of Devachan is that it is a world of thought. A man in Devachan is described as a Devachani. The word Devachan is etymologically inaccurate, and therefore misleading.